Again, there's a continual experiment with how to use this classroom. And today there are a lot of figures in the lecture. And so I was hoping that you folks would open up your laptops, download the figures from the wiki, and then you can look at them while I lecture. And then I won't have to monkey with the screen, which would be very nice. Sorry? 12 one figures, the figures for today's lecture. Okay, good. That's it. Okay. There we go. Okay. Okay. Good. Do I want to write on the board about? Oh yes. Yeah. So. Okay, so once again, and then I'll start. So I asked you all to bring your computers today. And you don't all have to have your computers, but you should all be within like sight of someone who has their laptop open. And so the idea is that I don't want to, there are a lot of figures in the lecture today, and I don't want to keep putting the screen up and down if I don't have to. So what I would like you to do is go to the wiki and go to the standard model course, and then you'll find today's lecture. And next to it, there's something to click on which says figures. And if you do that, you'll get a PDF which contains all the figures of today's lecture. And if you just have them in front of you, then you'll understand what I'm talking about. Or if your neighbor has them in front, that's good enough. But if you're not sitting within view of a laptop, then you'll miss something of this lecture. Okay? And after the lecture, tell me if this works, because we can do it another way if it doesn't work. Okay, let's get started. So, one more thing about the wiki. You'll notice that next to the figures, there's a space for the lecture notes, which is not filled in yet. And I will try as hard as I can to get the first and second lecture notes up today. And in particular, there are things in the first lecture notes that you may need to do the problem set. So I'll try and get them up as soon as possible. Okay. Yesterday I told you at least a little about what leptons, quarks, mesons, and baryons are. And so these are the main actors in the discussion of the standard model. These are the particles that we observe. And we're going to try and figure out how the standard model works by making observations of these particles. So there's one more important thing that I need to tell you about particle physics before we can really get into the interactions of the standard model. And that is, now we have the particles, now how do we observe them? So as usual in physics, you should understand something about how experiments are actually done to figure out what they're measuring and whether that accords with what your picture is of what they're measuring. So one thing you can say is what elementary particle experiments do is you arrange for some elementary particle collisions, and then you photograph them or measure them in some way. And you try and use the statistics of those collisions in order to learn something about the fundamental interactions. Now, This now brings up the question, what actually do we mean by taking a photograph of a high-energy physics event? And so that's really what I'd like to discuss in some detail in this lecture. Those of you who look at the historical papers on the wiki will notice that many of the earlier papers, basically you have one or two types of apparatus, and they measure properties either of one particle or a very small number of particles in very specific ways. But one of the things that happened in particle physics in the 1970s, and this is also the era when people went from fixed target experiments, where you had an accelerator and a target, to colliding beam experiments, came a philosophy that detectors should really understand all aspects of the event. Part of that was just the fact that at the colliding beam machines, the event rates were much lower. And so you had to suck much more information out of every collision you made. In any event, the kind of detector that we have now is better exemplified by the thing that you see in page 2 of the PDF in the figures. So this is one of your standard 1990s era particle detectors. This particular one I happen to be very familiar with because it's sitting on the back lot at SLAC. It's the detector called SLD. And what you see is that it's basically made of layers, every layer carrying out a different operation. And then the totality of those layers would give you an overall picture of the event. This detector was built to study electron-positron annihilation, making the Z boson, which we're going to meet a little later in the course. The Z is one of the fundamental quanta of the weak interactions. So you have E plus E minus going to the Z, and then the Z decays. And roughly, there are five types of Z decays. The Z can decay to quarks, to electrons, to muons, to taus, or to neutrinos. And these five decays present very different aspects, very different pictures in the detector. So I think if you now go to page 3 of the PDF, you'll see a very nice figure from one of the competing experiments on the Z0, Aleph, of what these events look like. Of course, the neutrinos don't look like anything, because neutrinos are highly penetrating. They will go through the detector without leaving any signal, because, as I said before, neutrinos have no charge, no strong interactions. They only interact through the weak interactions. However, these pictures all look different. The QQ bar, it's a cloud of dust, because eventually, as I said, the quarks are permanently confined. So what comes out is hadrons, and what comes out is some smear of hadrons. And what these smears of hadrons look like will be a major topic for the next, let's say, the part of the course starting tomorrow. The electrons make two tracks, and the muons make two tracks. But the tracks, if you look at the picture, look different. The muons are highly penetrating. The electrons are somehow registered differently in one of the elements of the detector. The taus look different again because, as I said yesterday, the tau has a relatively prompt decay. And what you see are the tau decay products. So if you just thumb through the next couple pages, you'll see a close-up picture of an E event from SLD, a tau event from SLD, and a QQ bar event from SLD. I'm not sure in what order. But what you can see is that the detector is somehow able to make... Oh, you're shaking your head. Are you getting this? You got the pictures? Well, just look at his. It's plenty. Okay, and so you'll see that there are quite distinct images, and then those images come with data. And so what I would like to do now is to explain to you how the various, sit next to someone where you can look on their laptop, because I have the figures are on the laptop. So let's now talk about what kind of technologies are involved in this, and how you can not only take the pictures, but actually make measurements and try and understand in a very precise way what's going on in these events. So we've got to discuss basically ways to measure all of the particles that are the final result of these kinds of interactions. So here we have hadrons. Here, electrons, muons. This thing will go to electrons, muons, and hadrons. Of course, for neutrinos, it's kind of futile, so please excuse me. Okay, so the first thing we ought to talk about is the simplest thing, charged particles. You all know, you all have an intuitive picture in your head about charged particles. A charged particle, moving relativistically, will stream through a medium. It will basically interact with the atoms in its path. It will ionize those atoms. The ionization is then a trail for the particle, and then you can try and design a device that picks up the ionization. So the ionization energy loss is given by something called the beta block formula. For a derivation of this formula, you can look in the appropriate chapter in Jackson, for example. And I won't write it in the greatest detail, but roughly dEdx, the energy loss per distance, 4 pi, Avogadro's number, the classical electron radius, so this thing here is E squared over mc squared. It's of order of Fermi. The mass of the electron times c squared, the charge of the particle which is going through, Z over A, so that's a property of the medium. 1 over beta squared, that's very important. The ionization is more effective if the charge is slower, so it glides by the atoms. And then there's also a term that increases logarithmically with gamma. And this is a typical excitation energy for an atom. Well, you can make this formula arbitrarily sophisticated. So, for example, if you look in the Review of Particle Properties, which I told you about yesterday, there's a section on the passage of particles through matter, and there you'll find quite accurate formulae that you could actually even use to design experiments. But this formula gives you kind of an idea of how it works. The important points are that the energy loss increases for small beta, and then it increases again logarithmically when the particle becomes ultra-relativistic. So I think on page 8 of the PDF, there's a graph from the particle data book of the energy loss for a muon going through copper, something you might want to think about, as a function of the energy. And roughly, it has this structure. There's the 1 over beta squared. This is then rounded off when you begin to think about the kind of strong interactions of the very slow particle with nuclei. So down here, there's some phenomenological theory. Then beta block applies in some region. There's a minimum, and then this is the log of the energy. There's a rise, and then out in the high energy region, some new things happen. For one thing, the very relativistic muons will hit atoms and radiate hard gamma rays, which are not described by this formula. But generally, for muons, you have to be multi-TeV before that's an important effect. So in the range somewhere around 1 GeV to 1 TeV, beta block is a pretty good approximation. You get a shape like this. And in particular, for most of the muons that you measure, you're in the minimum of this curve. So the minimum of this curve will, depending on the material, be something like 1 to 2 MeV per meter per, 1 to 2 MeV divided by, gram centimeter squared. So of course, you should multiply by the density to get the MeV per centimeter. And this number here is called minimum ionizing. And I think the simple philosophy that you can take away is that every relativistic particle will burrow through a medium at some characteristic minimum ionizing rate of ionization, leaving a trail behind it. So this number is a good one to keep in mind as to how much energy you deposit. If you think about a GeV muon, losing in water an MeV per centimeter can burrow through a lot of water before you stop it. And the same is true for a pion, a proton, whatever. Sometimes you hear the term MIP, minimum ionizing particle. So you can easily, an experimental particle physicist can easily design a detector to, quote, count MIPs. And you count the number of charged particles going through a volume. Okay. The energy loss, because of this dependence on the log of beta gamma, actually varies when the particle becomes very relativistic. And so I think if you now turn the page in the figures, you'll see some curves that plot this beta block relation on a different, and then there's a scale on the bottom, which is the energy for pions, kaons, and protons. And they're slightly shifted from one another because for a given momentum, the beta is different depending on the mass. So if I now plot this versus the momentum of the particle, a pion will have a curve like this, a kaon slightly displaced, and a proton somewhat displaced from that. And of course, electrons are way over here, although there are some other things I want to tell you about electrons. And so one thing you can do if you have something that samples the ionization, and especially samples it at many points so you get a good reading, is that you can try and figure out which of these curves, and then you measure the momentum. You figure out which of these curves you're on, and you can use that as a method for particle identification. So this is called particle identification by DEDX. And there are many, many experiments, in particular some of the Z0 experiments and also the CLIO experiment that we'll talk about on Thursday, use this method to try and, for example, tell pions from kaons from protons. Okay, yes.
How do we measure the momentum of the particle
then? We're getting there.
Okay.
Hang on. Okay. So this is just, for the moment, we're really, except for this business, pretty much just talking about finding the particles. So now, if you have some kind of gaseous medium, the particle, as I said, burrows through that, making an ionization trail. And then you can try and pick up that ionization trail in some way and figure out where the particle was. So most collider detectors of the 1980s to 2000s would use a gaseous medium for this. There are two things that compete with one another here. The first is that, of course, if you have a medium, a particle will not only ionize that medium, it'll also scatter, just elastic Coulomb scattering from the nucleus. And a useful formula is that the RMS scattering is a momentum of something like 13 MeV divided by beta Cp, the charge of the particle, and then the distance it travels over x0, which is a number called the radiation length, which I'll discuss in some detail later in the course. But for the moment, just think of it as being a few centimeters. So the idea is that every few centimeters, the particle suffers a significant Coulomb scattering, and it kind of does a random walk in terms of the angle of its trajectory. The random walk is what gives you the square root of x. And so if you have a dense medium, it doesn't matter how well you're measuring the positions. The particle wanders around in orientation and eventually gets out of its simple track. So typically, people would use gaseous detectors. And two of the kinds of detectors you'll read about are drift chambers and something called a TPC, a time projection chamber. actually, in this class also are all kinds of older detectors, like a cloud chamber, a bubble chamber, a spark chamber. These are all ways of visualizing the ionization. A bubble chamber is probably the most elegant. You have a superheated liquid, and then the ionization basically, so you basically take a liquid, you have a big plunger, you expand it, so you lower the pressure suddenly. The particles go through. The ionization forms a place where bubbles can nucleate. And then you physically take a picture of it. And then the bubble trail is where the particle went. And so those of you who pick up the paper, for example, on the discovery of the omega minus, this technique is used to make very accurate tracks of the charged particles in those events. However, the more modern technology would do something a little different. You'd have a very diffuse gaseous environment. You have some electric fields in that gas. The electric field then drifts the ionization from one place to another. And then, because you know exactly when the collision occurs, you use timing to figure out how far that ionization drifted, and then you get a three-dimensional space point. And a TPC takes that to the extreme. You have basically a big cylinder with an overall electric field in it. And you, in a TPC, you drift along the field line for meters and pick it up at the end. So there are no wires. There's just gas in the interior. And it's as diffuse as you like. Nowadays, however, there's another technology that's coming in, which is precision silicon detectors. So typically, a drift chamber, a TPC, can achieve. So the question, of course, is how accurately can you measure this point here? And for a drift chamber or a TPC, you're talking about 100 microns. If you have a silicon wafer, there's more material. But the silicon wafer, you can lay down a very fine pattern on it. And so you can think that for silicon, you can get to 10 microns. And so that, if you are very careful not to put too much silicon in so you don't severely interfere with the paths of the particles, this is often a better compromise for how accurately you can measure the path versus how much multiple scattering you induce.
So you mean moving the particle through silicon rather than through a diffuse gas?
Right. So for example, in the LHC detectors, Atlas and CMS, what you have are basically arrays like this, which are strips of silicon with, let's say, a 30 or 40 micron pitch. And then, so these things would be striped like that, and a particle would deposit ionization in one line. And then you'd have another piece of silicon going across. And you'd find the energy deposited there. And then you have a space point localized to very high accuracy. So silicon detectors are more robust if you have a very dirty accelerator environment, too. So that's another advantage for using this thing at the LHC. So in the Z0 experiments that I'll describe, this is the main tracking technology used. For the next generation, the LHC, it's mainly these silicon detectors. Okay. Let me figure out where I am in these notes. Okay. Let's see. Muons are the most penetrating particles. Muons, they have electromagnetic interactions, but they don't have the effects for the electron that I'm going to talk about a little later in the lecture, basically because they're heavier. I'm also going to talk about measuring the properties of hadrons by using the hadron-nucleus interaction. And muons don't have a hadron-nucleus interaction. They just have ordinary Coulomb scattering and other electromagnetic processes. So a muon is something that will penetrate meters of iron. And so you can take advantage of this, and this is typically done, again, if you remember the picture of the SLD, by just having a huge amount of stuff. And then outside, you'll have some iron plates. And anything that gets through that is probably a muon. By then, there's so much multiple scattering, it doesn't make much sense to have a precision detector here. So typically, you'll have something like plastic scintillator. So layers of iron in plastic scintillator. And so using this arrangement is called a hodoscope. That is to say, paths set at 90 degrees so that you can identify the two-dimensional point of impact of a particle. Some kind of hodoscopic arrangement of scintillator with plates of iron is a very typical technique for tracking muons. And in fact, if you look at the CMS detector at the LHC, which there's a picture at the very end of the slides, you'll see that kind of outside its magnet, the CMS is just a huge structure that's exactly like this. Good. Okay. The next thing is, as Chris asked, momentum measurement. Okay, so now we have some idea about how to find out where the particle is. So now we need to do something to it in order to figure out what its momentum is. And the obvious thing to do is to put it in a magnetic field. So if I have my let's say, again, cylindrical detector, and I look at it end on, and I put a magnetic field that, let's say, goes into the blackboard. So this is what you would call a solenoidal magnetic field. Then a particle coming at 90 degrees will bend in one direction or another, depending on whether it's positively or negatively charged. And by measure of the bending angle, or the radius of curvature, you then determine the momentum of the particle. You can easily, as well as I can, open Jackson and get a precise formula for this. But as something to memorize, this formula is very convenient. The transverse momentum per distance is equal to 300 MeV per Tesla meter times the B field that you apply. So in the LHC detectors, you'll typically have a 2-4 Tesla solenoidal field going through a cylindrical volume. And then what you see is that you get a bending of 300 MeV per meter, and then you divide that by whatever was the initial, this applies to relativistic particles, energy or momentum normal to the B field. So now, what do you measure? Well, now let's think about this track. Yes?
But if we're losing energy to the ionization.
Oh, but we're in, but that amount of energy loss is trivial.
Okay. I didn't know this.
Right. So this thing is it's basically either an empty volume which is filled with gas or filled with just occasional planes of very thin silicon wafers. So you need to account for it, but the energy loss is basically trivial. And so the thing will just follow a circular or helical path. And so now let's think a little more about that path. So the path bends like this. And what you'd like to do is to measure some number of space points here so you can detect the difference between that path and a straight line. So if this distance, let's say, is L, this distance here is called the sagitta of the path. And so what you're trying to do is to detect the difference between this path and this path so that you measure that number. And this is obviously not an issue if you have a particle of a few hundred MeV. You'll see it actually follow a circle. If you have a several hundred GeV or TeV particle, then it really becomes an issue. And let me just write this. formula. So the sagitta is a half r theta squared. And so just plugging in these numbers for an ultra-relativistic particle, 300 MeV per Tesla meter times a half times bl squared over e. So you make the sagitta larger by having a larger magnetic field, by having a larger moment arm to measure that small deviation here. And of course, as the energy goes up, the power of this technique goes down. Because this is what you measure, and you're going to turn that into a momentum, the accuracy of a momentum measurement depends on 1 over e, or rather 1 over pt, the momentum of the particle transverse to the magnetic field. And so then, very typically, you will get, as the dominant term, the error in a momentum measurement so the thing you're measuring is 1 over e, or 1 over the transverse momentum. And so then you'll get the error in a momentum measurement proportional to 1 over pt squared. And so this is then the thing that affects you when you have like a very energetic particle, let's say a TeV muon at the LHC. So let me write a typical, let me write a typical formula. I didn't write that correctly. What I should have written here is sigma of 1 over pt is roughly constant. And so when you translate that into a sigma, the sigma will then grow like pt squared. So the error in pt divided by pt will be something like pt, and then there'll be a term that is combined with that for multiple scattering. So for example, I happen to have the numbers around for the ATLAS detector at the LHC. So this number here is 3 × 0.6 × 10⁻⁴, and then something like 1%. And then this depends on the orientation that the particle presents to the silicon. Basically, at a glancing angle, it has to go through a lot more silicon, and there's more multiple scattering. So this is the thing from this effect and this part here from multiple scattering. The net effect, if you put in the numbers, is that a 50 or 100 GeV particle will be measured with a momentum at a few percent accuracy, which is what you're striving for. Okay. Now, there's another trick that you can do with the technique of high-precision silicon trackers, which is that you can put them very close to the interaction point and try to measure whether a track comes exactly from the interaction point or not. So this is kind of interesting. And the reason it's interesting has to do with the properties of heavy quarks. So yesterday I told you about the quarks U, D, and S. Of course, there are three more kinds of quarks called C, B, and T, charm, bottom, and top. Top I'm going to talk about at the very end of the course. But charm and bottom are the normal stuff of modern high-energy experimental physics. And very often, it's interesting to find specifically events where charm and bottom quarks are produced. So a way to do that is to recognize that these quarks, like these, will decay to lighter quarks by the weak interactions in the same way that muon and tau decay to the electron by weak interactions. Now, for pions and kaons, we saw that the decay path can be many meters, hundreds of meters sometimes. For these heavier quarks, the decay rate goes up basically as some high power of the mass of the quark. But nevertheless, the decay paths can still be macroscopic. So for the for the bottom quark that lives in mesons called B plus or minus and B zero, the C tau, so you remember last time I quoted some C taus as a characteristic length, is about half a millimeter. For the charm quark, the D plus, the one that contains a charm and a anti-down quark, the C tau is almost that long, about a third of a millimeter. For the D0, it's rather shorter, a tenth of a millimeter. But a tenth of a millimeter is still a whole 100 microns. And then you also get the benefit of gamma. These particles are often produced relativistically. And so then the thing becomes a millimeter distance. And well, now, you know, you have to think a little, because these detectors I'm describing to you are huge. They're larger than this room. But nevertheless, if you can really do precision measurements, you can measure a displacement of a millimeter. And so you can try and measure that displacement in two ways. First of all, you can figure out exactly where the particles collide and make the primary interaction. And very often, there are tracks coming out of that point. But more often, you look at several events, and you try and accumulate statistics on where exactly that point is. And then a track can come in like this, and you try and measure the impact parameter. With which that track misses the primary vertex. Another technique that you can use is if you have, especially for the case of B, where there are several charged particles that come out of the B decay, you can try and recognize the tracks are coming from a secondary vertex. Which is located a few millimeters away from the primary interaction. So I think on pages 10, 11, 12 of the figures, there's an example of an event where the Z decays to BB bar that was observed by the SLD detector. So if you look at page 10, you see that that looks, well, just pretty much like the QQ bar event that you looked at earlier. Maybe it's a little busier, but it's not atypical. But now, the SLD had an array like this of CCDs, charge-coupled device silicon wafers. They're actually two-dimensional devices within two dimensions of 40 micron pitch. And so if you go to the next slide, which is slide 11, you'll see a blow-up of the very center of that event on slide 10. And then you see the array of CCDs. And you see the hits in the CCDs that are marking tracks. And then if you turn the page once more, you will see the blow up of the interior of that figure. And you'll see that the tracks are actually coming from three different places. There are a few tracks that come from the interaction vertex. And then displaced over to the left and also over to the right, there are two vertices from which more tracks are emerging. And basically, a B meson is traveling a few millimeters from here to here and then decaying. And so using that technique, one can tag the appearance of heavy quarks in a high-energy physics event. The very next slide, page 13, is actually kind of interesting. As an experimenter, you want to be able to measure the resolution of your measurement of impact parameter. That is, obviously, if I have a non-zero impact parameter on a track, it may be because there's actually some particle that went and decayed over here. But it may also be because I just didn't measure the track correctly because of the there are always errors in any kind of measurement system. So there's a nice self-calibrating way to measure your ability to measure impact parameter. If you compare this situation, where the impact parameter basically points in the positive direction, and this situation, where the impact parameter points in the negative direction with respect to the eventual path of the particle, you can see that this kind of situation can be produced if a particle moving together with the decay product you're looking at goes forward and decays. But this mechanism can't give rise to a track with negative impact parameter. The B quark moving this way would decay in that direction. So typically, if you plot the number of particles versus the impact parameter, then you would see a curve like this. For light quarks, where everything is coming out promptly, you see a distribution that's totally symmetric on the two sides. For charm quarks, you see a tail like that. And for bottom quarks, you see a longer tail, reflecting the longer average lifetime of bottom quark mesons. And so if you then measure this distribution, this side gives you your resolution. And then whatever the sigma is there, you go out to several sigma, and things that are out here are quite likely to be heavy quark mesons. And there's an illustration of that, I think, on the next page, if you go over.
Is that the opal slide?
That's the opal slide. So there's some funny name given to the vertical horizontal axis, but basically it's very close to the impact parameter of tracks that's measured. Okay. Now we've talked a lot about charged particle detection. But of course, a lot of what comes out of a high energy physics event is neutral particles. Also, there's the problem that when tracks are very close together, you may not be able to distinguish them. And so even for charged particles, you may want some other method of estimating what's actually coming out of an event. So far, we've been talking about mainly tracking and trying to measure momentum either by DEDX or better by basically the curvature of tracks in a magnetic field. So now I'd like to go to the flip side of that, which is calorimetry, the attempt to measure the actual energy that's deposited by particles and to try and totally absorb particles and measure their energy. So here it's really useful to start with electrons and photons. In fact, with photons. Photons, in all of the detectors that I've described so far, photons are basically invisible. They easily go through meters of gas. Now we're talking about gamma ray photons. They easily go through meters of gas, making no signal. I think on page 14 of the figures, you'll see some plots of the cross-section of gamma rays on carbon and lead. And they have those cross-sections have the characteristic form that down here you have Rayleigh scattering, elastic scattering of the photons. And that falls off rather rapidly. And then there's some minimum. And then there's some other process that picks up at high energy. And very significantly, the energy where these new processes pick up is about 1 MeV. So let's now talk about what those processes are. So if I have a photon, and now Z is not the Z boson, it's a heavy nucleus with charge Z. In the field of the heavy nucleus, the photon, if it's sufficiently energetic, that is, if it's above an MeV, can convert to an electron-positron pair. So here's a typical diagram. So this vertex is proportional to the charge of the nucleus. The photon comes in. The kinematics is really very collinear. And out of this comes an electron-positron pair. And then similarly, there's a process for an electron where it will interact with a heavy nucleus and radiate a photon. So this is called Bremsstrahlung. And this is conversion. So these processes both become important when the energies involved are much higher than the electron mass. So we're now talking about several MeV to, you know, arbitrarily many GeV photons and electrons. Now, this is where this concept that I mentioned before called the radiation length comes in. As you go through a material, the characteristic distance in which one of these processes occurs is the radiation length. It's called x0, and here's a simplified formula for x0, about 20 times alpha times the classical electron radius, Avogadro's number divided by A, and very significantly, z squared. So materials with high nuclear charge are much more effective. Yes?
In your Bruns drawing diagram, I think the electrons should continue as well?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I thought that was an arrow pointing to the...
No. Okay. So you get an electron and a photon. And so then there's a distance, which is given by this formula, which will tell you the characteristic distance as you penetrate the material in which one of these reactions occurs. And so let me make a little table here of copper, iron, and lead. And the radiation length is 19 centimeters, 1.8 centimeters, and half a centimeter. Now, let's say a GeV photon comes and impacts a lead brick. So in the first half a centimeter, this will convert to an electron-positron pair. In the next half a centimeter, each of those particles will bremsstrahlung a photon. In the next half a centimeter, each of those particles will do their thing. And in not too many centimeters, you'll build up a very large number of electrons, positrons, and photons. So this is called an electromagnetic shower. And what you see is that the energy will very rapidly be degraded. Essentially, the depth of the shower will be something like the logarithm of the original photon energy divided by the MeV energy scale. The shower continues until an energy called the critical energy. Where basically the energy loss of an electron to bremsstrahlung is equal to the ionization loss that I talked about before. When you get below the critical energy, the electrons lose energy by ionization and the shower burns out. And the critical energy roughly is the radiation length, a characteristic 21 MeV. I'm confused. 800 MeV divided by Z. That's what I should have said. So again, the higher the nuclear charge, because there's an extra power of Z with respect to beta block, the lower the critical energy and the more the shower proceeds. Okay, well now you see we're doing pretty well, because now these gamma rays that were formerly invisible, it's now clear how to measure their energy. You have some lead or some other heavy material. Now, lead, unfortunately, is, you know, it's stupid, like lead. So you should interspace these with some medium that can measure the ionization. You start the electromagnetic shower going. And then whenever there are electrons and positrons in this medium, they make ionization that can be sampled by some device that can pick up ionization. And so then if you try and measure the total amount of ionization that's produced, that should be proportional to the energy of the original gamma ray. The thickness of the device is determined by the radiation length. You need 10 or 12 radiation lengths to contain the shower, typically. The transverse spread of the shower is given by something called the Molière radius, for which the formula is Rm is equal to the radiation length, 21 MeV, divided by the critical energy. So usually the Molière radius, this is a small number, as you see. And so typically these showers are very narrow. And then you would try and pick up ionization from them and figure out how much total ionization was deposited. Okay. So in figure 15, you will see a simulation of an electron-induced electromagnetic shower. And you see, characteristically, there's a shower maximum. The energy is converted from the electron mainly into photons. And then as the photons convert, everything dies down in of order 10 radiation lengths. Now, what kind of technology do you use for this? Well, in SLD and also in ATLAS, the technology is lead plates, which are immersed in liquid argon. And then the gaps will be filled with liquid argon. The ionization in the liquid argon drifts arbitrarily far. It's a noble gas. And then at various places, you pick up that ionization and measure an electronic signal. Another technique is to use, again, some other heavy material, and then a scintillator, a plastic scintillator, to measure the ionization in the plastic scintillator. Another technique, which is used by CMS, is to use a crystal made of heavy material. So CMS uses a crystal called lead tungstate. So think about this, lead tungsten oxide. So this is a glass. It comes in crystals that are like that. It's completely transparent, except you put in some doping material that scintillates. So everywhere locally, it's detecting the ionization. And it weighs as much as a lead brick. And so in that way, they achieve very high accuracy photon resolution. Now, what's the resolution of a total absorption calorimeter? Well, the most important effect usually is that most of the calorimeter is dead or dumb. And only when there's active material are you actually measuring what's going on. So there's a sampling effect. And so the statistics of that sampling typically determine your resolution, which means then that the resolution in energy divided by the energy is something divided by the square root of E, like a random walk. So for ATLAS, the number expected is 10% over root E plus some term that there's always something when the square root of E becomes arbitrarily large. And for CMS, these crystals actually give some advantage. And they expect something like 4% over root E. Okay. Now, with electromagnetic calorimetry, we can get the energies of electrons and photons. And then you've got to remember also pi zeros. Because the pi zero, remember, decays in some tens of nanometers to two photons, two gamma rays, which then are just like any other gamma rays, and we can detect them with this technique. However, if we'd like to measure the energies of other kinds of hadrons, pions, kaons, protons, actually the most insidious ones are things like neutrons, for which they're neutral, so they don't make tracks. They don't have this electromagnetic effect. So we need to, for neutrons, for lambdas, Xe particles, those are all produced. If we want to find them, we have to do some kind of gross hadron calorimetry. So the principle of hadron calorimetry is very similar to the principle of electromagnetic calorimetry, except that the distance scale is larger. And intrinsically, the process is much messier. And so let me just tell you a little about that. So what we're relying on here for hadron calorimetry is that a hadron, let's say a pi plus, will come in. It will at some point hit a nucleus. Now, a pi plus hitting a nucleus will make some stream of high energy particles with a distribution of energies. Some of those high energy particles will be pi pluses, some will be pi minuses, but a lot will be pi zeros. So what we're hoping happens is that pi plus plus a nucleus gives you some kind of disrupted nucleus and some pi pluses and pi zeros, maybe a kaon or two. So the pi zero then immediately decays to two gammas. And then if we have some electromagnetic calorimeter there, we can measure that energy. And so gradually, through a number of scatters, the energy is degraded by processes like this. And so now let's think a little about the lengths. So the characteristic length would be the inverse of the length we're talking about would be the density divided by the inelastic cross-section. An elastic pion nucleon scatter doesn't do any good, so you need the inelastic cross-section, which is a fraction of the total cross-section. And when you put in the numbers, the interaction length for these materials would be 39 centimeters in copper, 17 centimeters in iron, and it's about the same, 18 centimeters in lead. So now we have kind of a prescription for designing a hadron calorimeter. What we want to do is we'll have the same kind of thing that we had for an electromagnetic calorimeter, namely some pieces of metal and then some device that will sample the shower. But now there are two scales involved. We have this as the characteristic distance of hadronic interactions. But then after each hadronic interaction, there's an electromagnetic shower. And this is the characteristic size of the electromagnetic shower. And if we go more than, let's say, 5 or 6 radiation lengths, we get an inaccurate sampling of the electromagnetic shower. So usually the best choice here is iron, where the hadronic and electromagnetic distances are better matched, but it's still a pretty heavy material. And so what you have in actually ATLAS and CMS and in SLD is something where you have iron and then plastic scintillator or some other technology to read out the ionization. Basically, the iron plates have to be a few times this distance in order to get a good sampling of the electromagnetic component. And then there's a lot more. This process is much less regular than the electromagnetic shower. In particular, it depends crucially on how many pi zeros are produced in the first interaction. In hadron collisions, there's something called a leading particle effect, where the fastest hadron actually carries most of the energy, and the rest of the energies are distributed logarithmically. So if you have the pi plus scattering from a nucleus and going to a pi plus plus junk, then you go basically two stages in before anything happens. If the pi plus charge exchanges and becomes a pi zero, most of the energy is deposited right there. And so that kind of fluctuation is an intrinsic property of hadronic showers that really limits your ability to measure them accurately. And so, for example, I gave these numbers for electromagnetic calorimeters in ATLAS. For the hadron calorimeter, the comparable number is something like 56% over root 8. And for CMS, because they have such a beautiful technology for the electromagnetic, the hadron calorimeter is severely compromised because everything's got to fit in that space. And so it's something like 110% over root 8. And so you have to understand what the accuracy of different components is and try and put the stress on the most accurate components in order to get out the information you want. Yes?
Sigma of E divided by E dimensionless. And here you have 1 over square root of...
Oh, I'm sorry. Energy is in GeV.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, it should be dimensionless. But always in these formulas, the energy is in GeV. So it's not, this is a convenient way to quote the point. Okay. So now, to make a complete detector design, you now have to put all this together. And so if you now, we're just about done. If you now just look at the last couple slides, figures 17 and 18 show the plan of the SLV detector. And then the last slide is a kind of plan view of the CMS detector. And then you see all these things put together to kind of get a holistic picture of the event. So looking at the SLD, you see very close to the interaction point, you have the CCDs. Then outside that, you have a drift chamber, which is a gaseous volume that does the tracking. Outside that, you have something I didn't talk about, which is a Cherenkov ring imaging detector that does very good pi and kaon separation. Outside that, you have the magnet. Now, the magnet is essential to do the charged particle tracking. But for calorimetry, it's just dead volume. It's dead material that's not sampled. So it's bad for calorimetry. So they put the electromagnetic calorimeter, which is a more precise device, inside the magnet. But then the hadron calorimeter is outside the magnet because it costs a lot of money to fill a huge volume with magnetic field. So when you design a detector, all of these compromises have to be made. You have to stack together the elements so that the kind of total absorption devices don't wipe out the quality of the precision devices. And then anything that gets through the whole thing is probably a muon. And so the outer part of the hadron calorimeter is also your muon detector. So what I suggest you do is to study these two pictures and try and see if you can understand how these devices are built in relation to what I've explained to you in this lecture. And I think if you can visualize how different kinds of events look in these devices, then you'll be well prepared to understand when I start showing you experimental results in the next lecture. So that's good. Thank you very much.